think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have for today's broadcast. So I'm going to do a brief introduction to Judy as she comes on camera and I call up her presentation materials. So I'm going to put Judy here on the split screen with me, and I will let everybody know that we are all very fortunate to be joined by Judy Canova, who has a bachelor's and a master's in geology and is a registered professional geologist. She has worked as a technical support hydrogeologist in the Superfund program for 37 years and is a published author. In 2018, Judy moved over to EPA Region 5 to join their Superfund program, and she has worked as an RPM in addition to providing hydrogeology technical support to other RPMs in that region. From 2022 to 2024, Judy served as a co-chair of the EPA's Groundwater Forum, and she'll tell us a little bit more about the forum here in just a moment. So, Judy, I see you are on. I think you're ready to go, right?
I think so. Can you hear me okay?
I can. Please feel free to take it away.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for the opportunity to talk today about a topic that I think is important, which is how we can improve how we select groundwater remedies and how we help them perform well. This material is sponsored by the Environmental Protection Agency Technical Support Project Groundwater Forum. If you've never heard of the Groundwater Forum, there's a little QR code there that you can scan and get some more information. The Groundwater Forum mission is to support technology transfer throughout the country for groundwater characterization and remediation. We also try to build consistency between the EPA regions with respect to how we apply guidance. From time to time, we work on issue papers and fact sheets on topics of interest to us to move the science forward. And then from time to time, we also get involved reviewing and commenting on groundwater guidance, publications, and documents. The Groundwater Forum is made up of hydrogeologists from each region, as well as geologists, scientists, and engineers from the Office of Research and Development and headquarters. We also have several state participants. Voting members in the Groundwater Forum are regional employees who support either our RCRA or Superfund programs. They have geology degrees or substantive geology experience. And with that, I think I'm going to move into the main presentation. So, the foundation of this presentation was an evaluation I did of innovative technologies, just as an indication of how old I may be. When I first started, the only technology available for contaminated groundwater was pump and treat. Since then, there have been a lot of what we call innovative technologies, although now many of them have been used enough that they probably aren't considered innovative anymore, except by old timers like me. So I thought after quite a few years of implementation that maybe there were some lessons that could be learned about how these newer technologies were working. So I did a file review. I grabbed a whole bunch of documents back when we had hard copies out of a file room and sat down and went through them to see what types of technologies were being used to treat contaminated groundwater. I ended up looking at over 100 sites. My theory was that some technologies might be more effective than others. And what I discovered was several examples of success and failure, as well as some lessons learned. And I feel like we can improve the success of technology selection, implementation, and monitoring. So, this is a summary of the technologies I looked at, or the sites that I looked at. We had enhanced reductive dechlorination at 39 sites, in-situ chemical oxidation at 35 sites, oxygen release compounds at 10 sites, permeable reactive barriers, 8 sites, in-situ chemical reduction, 7. 7 sites had phytoremediation, 5 had recirculation wells, 4 had thermal technologies, 3 were zero-valent iron, and 9 were something that I just categorized as miscellaneous. And so I'm going to focus on the most popular remedies for today for the lessons learned. Before I do that, I want to talk about success because I did label sites based on whether they were being successful or not. And in my dictionary, this is not an official definition, this is Judy Canova's definition. Success is when you make good progress towards meeting your goals and you have an expectation that you will be able to meet your goals in a reasonable period of time. I also had a category called partially successful because what I found was at a lot of sites, progress was made, but it wasn't going to do to reach the eventual goal. And maybe some tweaking was needed, some modifications were needed. Sometimes an alternate remedy was brought in just to help it along. Those I called partially successful to be nice. And then there were some where it just flat out didn't work, and we had to go back to the drawing board, or the person performing the work had to go back to the drawing board and try something different. Or perhaps the plume was mobilized as a result of the attempt at remediation. So I did call that a failure as well. So, here are some of the technologies and their success rates. Permeable reactive barriers did not have a single site that I called successful. And there's a good reason, and I will show you that. I believe we have improved how we're doing PRB, so I am sure there are many in the record that are successful. So this is not a slam on permeable reactive barriers, but more of a lesson of what do we need to check for with permeable reactive barriers. Oxygen release compounds were 20%, had a 20% success rate, in situ chemical oxidation, 32%, enhanced reductive dechlorination, 23%, and phytoremediation, based on my scale, had a 17% success rate. So the primary causes of poor remedy performance of those partially successful or failures really all tie back into three main topics. There are some other ones, but the ones I want to focus on today are inadequate characterization, incompatible geochemistry, and also implementation issues. I'm going to start with permeable reactive barriers. I imagine most of you know how they function, but in case there's a new person that's listening in, a permeable reactive barrier works by emplacing a permeable mixture of reactive material within the water table. The hope is to place the barrier perpendicular to groundwater flow direction. And in theory, what we want is contaminated groundwater to flow into the barrier. And then we want it to react with material in the barrier, meeting our goals, our regulatory criteria. And then move out of the barrier into the area down gradient and mixing with the water down gradient of that barrier. Hopefully, that water will eventually meet regulatory criteria. So, some things about permeable reactive barrier longevity. Longevity is an issue for PRBs in terms of how fast your groundwater is flowing, how high your levels, concentrations of contaminants are. The thickness can be designed to help a permeable reactive barrier last longer, but if you have clogging, you can significantly reduce the longevity. And clogging is the reason we had a couple of failures of PRBs. Estimates of lifespan of 10 to 20 years were not uncommon when I did my review, and I think it's probably still about the same. So we're going to stop here and have a poll to see what your experience is with permeable reactive barriers.
All right, I'm about to launch a poll that's going to pop up in a new window for everyone. So allow me to click this button, and you all should see a new window floating on the screen. Now, this question or window is going to contain three specific question. So I'll ask you to answer each one by clicking the circle to the left of each answer that you think is correct, and then scrolling on down through that little pop-up window to respond to the other questions in this poll. When you're all done, hit the blue submit button in the lower right corner. If for any reason you don't see the poll window, it might be buried under a three dots or more menu. And if you don't see it at all, you can't find it. That's why we've put the questions here on the slide. You are certainly welcome to simply type your responses into the Q&A. So our first question is asking if you have one or more projects with a PRB, the yes or no question. The other question we're asking is what type of contamination is being addressed? Is it metals, volatile organics, other? Is it not applicable? You're doing something else? And then we're also asking what is the expected lifespan of the PRB? Is it 10 years, 20 years, or more than 20 years? Now, about 70% of you have responded to this poll, which is excellent to hear. And again, this is just to give us a bit of a sense of your experience with this particular technology. So I'll go ahead and close the poll down here in 3, 2, 1. And Judy, let's take a look at these results. Now, for our very first question, almost two-thirds of the audience do not have projects with a PRB. So I'll just say that off the bat. But those who do have PRBs, it looks like almost half of them are using it for something other than metals, volatile organics, or something else. But about a third of them are using it for those volatile organics. And then looking down at that third question, the vast majority, about half of them, thought that the expected lifespan was 10 years. And then about a third of them said 20 years, and about 20% said more than 20 years. All right, I'll turn the floor back to you, Judy.
Thank you. That was interesting for me. All right, let's see. So here's a picture of a permeable reactive barrier being placed out of one of the documents that I reviewed. A nice little trenching device that digs a hole and puts in material at the same time. This is the sort of the semi-finished product. They had to bench to get to the depth, the target depth that they wanted to get to. So back to the success and failure question. I looked at eight sites. We had two of them that failed because of clogging. That was a geochemistry issue. I'll probably talk about that two or three times, where the groundwater was high in sulfate, had a low pH, and a pilot test of a permeable reactive barrier using calcium carbonate was performed. And if you have a background in chemistry, you will know that if you mix calcium carbonate with sulfate and groundwater, you will end up with gypsum fairly quickly. And there was an instantaneous clogging of that one. And then the other one, they tried calcium polysulfide, had a similar reaction. It took a little bit longer for it to clog, a couple of weeks. So those are the ones that, nope, back to the drawing board. It's not that a PRB wouldn't work. It's just that the type of material that they used was not a good choice. We went back and recommended a sulfate reduction technology, which was used and was shown to be successful without clogging. So it's not the PRB itself. It was the type of material that was being used. Six of them were partially successful, and then there is an update since this material was put together that there was one that I worked on directly, where we made a few minor tweaks, and it was a successful one before we ever, as we implemented that particular one. So that was good. So the primary causes of poor performance of permeable reactive barriers: inadequate characterization, incompatible geochemistry, and implementation issues. Here is one of the sites that I looked at. The pink line that you see is the location of the permeable reactive barrier. The black lines indicate the potentiometric surface. And one of the things that you probably notice right off the bat is that the potentiometric surface is not a straight line, and therefore the permeable reactive barrier is not directly perpendicular to the groundwater flow direction. So what did that cause? Well, in this case, we had flow around the end of the permeable reactive barrier. This is why I kind of called this partially successful because where the contaminated water flowed into the PRB and moved out of the PRB, it was treated and it did reach regulatory criteria. But because of the flow around the end, it couldn't be, I couldn't call this a successful PRB. I wouldn't recommend this exact PRB be installed. Not successful, but certainly working where the water is entering the wall and moving through. So was this a one-off? Unfortunately, no. In fact, all of the PRBs that were ranked as partially successful had flow around the end. This is a military base. They actually put in two permeable reactive barriers, which sometimes is a good idea when you have a large plume and you want to treat it in that 10-year or 20-year period of time. You just put them a 10 to 20-year time of travel apart, and you can address your entire plume if you have cut off the source. In this case, we have PCE, TCE, 11DCA, and 11DCE all moving around the end of the permeable reactive barrier, which is very disappointing for all the effort that went into that. So why is it that these PRBs were not successful? There's a lot of reasons why there may be groundwater flow around the ends. Maybe it's just difficult to match the aquifer permeability or get it consistent, because typically we see zones of higher and lower permeability within an aquifer. So I actually think maybe just installing a PRB can impact groundwater flow directions because of the fact that the PRB is going to be more consistent and not always match the aquifer. But we also have things like seasonal variations in groundwater flow directions. Maybe groundwater flow is one direction in the winter and another direction in the summer. And if that has not been evaluated and considered in the design, it can cause this flow around the end. In general, and I think this has improved over the years, the evaluation of water levels prior to installation has become a much more recognized issue for permeable reactive barriers. It needs to be done on a high-resolution scale in some cases, and certainly to consider these seasonal variations. And as I pointed out on that one slide, most potentiometric surfaces are not straight lines. A lot of sites are not. So I came up with an idea that maybe we should try doing a V-shaped PRB or maybe one with some elbows to try to address these curved potentiometric surfaces. And as I said, I think there are times when it's possible that the PRB is actually changing the local groundwater flow directions. So, as I said, V-shape was one idea I had that we tried that ended up working out nicely at one project. Elbows at ends, I have not tried. Early on, when PRBs were being used in the 2000s to 2010s, 20s, funnel and gate started becoming a popular thing because you can take the same idea for a PRB, and instead of having the entire PRB be permeable, you could put impermeable barriers on and have a gate in the middle with treatment media that contaminated water could pass through. And theoretically, you could change the treatment media within the funneling gate. That also helped overcome some of the issues with PRB design. So, for permeable reactive barriers, some of my recommendations: site characterization is very important. It's important to understand the aquifer heterogeneity and how it may interact with the design of the permeable reactive barrier. Doing those detailed evaluations of seasonal impacts on groundwater flow direction and making sure the chemistry is what you want it to be. If a chemist had looked at the one project that I looked at in the file review, I think they would have not recommended that particular type of reactive media. And design that permeable reactive barrier to address perturbations in groundwater flow, so that you have a little bit of wiggle room, sort of a safety margin. For performance monitoring of permeable reactive barriers, we recommend installation of several multi-level monitoring wells within the PRB to give you an idea of what's going on inside the permeable reactive barrier, but also make sure that you have monitoring points around the ends of the PRB, because if flow around the end is something that we're seeing consistently, and I saw it quite a bit during my file review, I think we need to be sure we're monitoring there to prevent that from happening, or if it does happen, to know how to respond. And with that, I'm going to stop and see if there are any questions about permeable reactive barriers. Jean, do we have any questions?
Oh, we have questions. So I'll just remind the audience if they haven't submitted their questions on in, you can continue to use that Q&A window at the bottom of your screen to send them in. The first question that I'm going to start with has come in from a few people, and they're looking for more information about the materials that were used in the PRB examples. Specifically, someone wanted to know, were any of them activated carbon?
Not the ones that I evaluated. They were not activated carbon. Most of them were mixtures of zero-valent iron and sand. The one that I was directly involved in was a sulfate reduction PRB, which used all kinds of sources of carbon, but not activated carbon.
Okay. They mention about that activated carbon idea because they're seeing it proposed to capture VOCs, and they thought it might provide more residence time for biodegradation that could occur or with some enhancement agents that could be added to the barrier. They just wondered if you've seen that as a successful approach.
I think that's a good approach to consider. When I did my file review was before activated carbon was really on the radar screen. And I am not involved with one right now that's activated carbon, but I definitely think it has good potential.
Okay. All right. How about getting into that sulfate reducing technology? Let's see. Oh, they want to know what exactly was it?
Okay. So it's really high tech, so get ready. It's a mixture of cow manure, which is the source of the sulfate reduction bacteria, wood chips, leaves, hay. We did bring in a little bit of cement kiln dust, a teeny little bit, to try to help with the pH, but not a lot. We did this as a pilot study before we did it as a long, full scale. It's actually in Technology News and Trends from way back in the day when we tested this and found that it was working and it was successful. And one of the things that we did with it was we did this pilot. We did find that the pilot impacted the groundwater flow direction. And that's one reason we tried the V-shaped approach, which seemed to work fine with monitoring wells around the ends. But we had access to a laboratory where we could do scanning electron microscopy to see what sort of precipitates are we forming and how much is coming out, and will we see clogging? Will this PRB eventually fill up with precipitate? And we were very pleased that we didn't see a whole lot of precipitates happening after several months of being in place. So that's probably the best summary I can give you on that.
Okay. All right. We've got a couple of more questions coming in about the materials and also the contaminants. So one is a very targeted question. Is there a particular material in the PRB that you found was the most useful, like less likely to clog?
Well, that really depends on your chemistry, and that's one of the take-home messages from here is be sure you understand the chemistry. And if you're trying to change, like if you're using an oxidizing PRB to treat groundwater that's reducing, be very, very careful, because when you try to change the chemistry like that, you can get fouling, and that's what causes clogging. So My recommendation overall is to use the same type of chemistry that is present in the groundwater. So, if your groundwater is highly reducing and it has VOCs, zero valent iron would be a recommendation, or carbon-coated zero valent iron is something that I look favorably on for PRBs. And in the case of the sulfate reduction, we had highly oxidizing water. That was a metals plume. And so adding, creating sulfate reduction within that wall was a really good technique rather than trying to change the pH because the sulfate reduction brought the metals out and of solution. And their ionic radius of metal is very small compared to the ionic radius of gypsum. So,
Okay, I'm going to take one more question here on PRBs, but there are a lot of really good questions in here. So I'm hopeful we'll be able to circle back to some of these at the end of today's session. But this question is about the installation techniques and if you noticed anything or an impact on the success rates. So they wonder, were these PRBs that you looked at installed using injections or they were predominantly installed using trenches? If they were injections, did you evaluate if there were any differences in the effectiveness between those two different installation techniques?
So back in the day when these PRBs were installed, these were some that probably were maybe 10 or so years after the technology was developed. So we were still doing the dig it up and use a trench box to and fill it in kind of technique. We didn't really have a lot of injection capabilities at that point. Now a lot more PRBs are being installed basically as overlapping injection points, which is probably easier in some respects than digging a hole in the ground and dumping stuff in. Some of these were trenched, as you saw, with the trencher with an automatic device that filled in behind the excavation. So all of the ones that I looked at were the old-timey dig a hole in the ground, put stuff in, and cover it up.
Okay. All right. Well, it's about 1:31 p.m. Eastern. Judy, I think we're going to stop with the question break here and
Okay.
carry on, but the audience keeps sending those questions in, and we will pause again for another Q&A break shortly.
All right. In situ chemical oxidation, it works by injecting an oxidant or a mixture of an oxidant and catalyst into the subsurface. Many oxidants are going to work on the indigenous native iron in the subsurface and organic matter in the subsurface. Sometimes we call that natural oxidant demand. And it will do that a lot of times before it will actually attack the contaminant. That's not always the case, but a lot of times it is, depending on your oxidant. How did in situ chemical oxidation do? We had a success rate of about 35%, partially successful 38%. We did have some failures in the record, ended up being 27%. And so let's find out why. The main cause of poor ISCO performance was incompatible geochemistry and implementation issues. With the incompatible geochemistry, if there's a strong contrast between the injectate and the subsurface, which in the case of ISCO would be if you're injecting a chemical oxidant into a highly reducing environment, it's more difficult to be successful. Implementation issues can be things like spacing of the injection points, as well as the ability of the subsurface to receive injectate. If there is incompatible geochemistry, sometimes there's fouling. But also, lithology can prevent the injectate from getting where you need it to go or where you're wanting it to go. So, our second poll of three, I believe we have three today. Have you used ISCO to treat groundwater contamination?
All right, so that new poll window should be popping up on the screen, and we're going to ask two questions this time. Just as Judy said, have you used ISCO to treat your groundwater contamination? Yes or no? And then how many ISCO sites have you reviewed? It could be 0 to 5, 5 to 10, or more than 10. So we're looking just to get a sense of the prevalence of this particular technology for those of you who use it at sites. I'll give you just a few more seconds to look at these questions and then respond. Again, if you have any issues accessing the poll, you are certainly welcome to simply type a response into the Q&A. It looks like about two-thirds of the audience have cast their vote. If you have a viewing party and have many professionals in the room, do your very best to get a group consensus on an answer and then cast one representative vote. Remember, we're not grading the answers here. And I think we've got about three-quarters of you having shared your answers. So let me close the poll here in 3, 2, 1. And Judy, it looks like we've got about 60% of them have used ISCO, but 40% have not. And more than three quarters have used them or have reviewed 0 to 5. But we do have a couple of seasoned pros with more than 10 sites with it.
Okay, great. Well, some of those seasoned pros may be able to speak more at a deeper level than I'm going to be talking about ISCO today. All right, let's keep going. I'm trying. There we go. Oop. Sorry about this. So I have an in situ chemical oxidation case study, and I am happy to present a success story for you. I think we learn more from failures, which is why I typically present the partially successful or the failures, because we learn from them. But in this case, I think there's some things to be learned from this particular case study. This was a Piedmont chemical manufacturing company that used ozone. And they did a pilot study of sea sparging and multi-level sparging. And I labeled this successful. You can decide for yourself when you see the information. So ozone is a chemical oxidant, and I think it has become more popular for certain applications because of its lifespan is short, but it's very effective. So depending on what you're trying to do, ozone can be great. So this is the plume to start with. It's a total VOC drawing. The primary contaminants were chlorobenzene and benzene. They are two great compounds for in situ chemical oxidation because they degrade aerobically. So even when the oxidation is done, if there is some left behind, you can still hope that there will be some aerobic degradation. One thing about this site that I think is very interesting is it's also includes bedrock. So if you look at the orange circle in the core of the plume, you'll see sort of a line running through that, and you can trace that line all the way across. That's actually the top of rock. So we had several points that were within the fractured rock. Now it is was highly fractured. This wouldn't be appropriate for rocks that had only a few fractures, but in this case, they thought it might work out okay. So here we are, 200 days later, after 200 days of ozone sparging, it was a 95% reduction of the total VOCs. We still have a little blob on the in the core of the plume. But now it's about 9.34 parts per million rather than over 20. I believe that if this had continued, they probably could have brought their concentrations down even more, which is why I felt like this was a successful application of this technology. So, how about some individual well information? This is a well that was directly down gradient of the ozone sparging area. On the bottom left, you'll see chlorobenzene was as high as 12 to start with MW15. The benzene was around 2 at the highest prior to the ozone sparging. And we have this nice record. For 5 years after the ozone sparging, that showed there really wasn't a lot of rebound. A lot of times with chemical oxidation, there's a lot of stories out there about rebound, and there's even planning for rebound, like we'll do some more injections because we're expecting rebound. But we really didn't see a lot of rebound here. So I thought that was a good message for this particular application. So how do we know the sea sparging actually worked with the ozone? Well, we can certainly look at the contaminant concentrations, but maybe the plume just moved. The other line of evidence that I like to use for sites is indicator parameters. So when we're doing chemical oxidation, I like to look at dissolved oxygen, oxidation reduction potential, and see do those numbers change during the sparging. And what we found at this site was we did have increases in DO and ORP in the bedrock wells. Here is the example of the oxidation reduction potential. Almost all of these points increased. Some increased dramatically, others a little bit. There's a couple that were kind of wobbly that didn't do a whole lot. But by and large, this shows oxidation reduction potential increased, and on average, at least 150 millivolts. So that was a good indication that the ozone sparging helped us. And then, secondly, the dissolved oxygen, similar type of reaction where we were around two to start with at some of these locations and got up as high as 14 during the ozone sparging. So, a line of evidence that yes, in situ chemical oxidation did its thing. So, now this is a not so successful story. Low country military site where chlorobenzene was being treated. Again, I'm in favor of chemical oxidation for chlorobenzene, but if your subsurface is highly reducing, it may need another look or more of an evaluation. At this site, we had DNAPL that was suspected at 13 monitoring wells. I say we, I'm talking about the people who did this work. I just was reviewing the file. There were three injection events. The first event targeted source material. The second and third events targeted the entire area. The treatment area was small, about 90 feet by 180 feet, and the spacing between the injection points was between 20 and 30 feet, which is fairly typical. This is a schematic of the site. The source area where they suspected DNAPL was present is highlighted in yellow. The purple squares are where injections occurred, and the green, I mean, the green, red dots are where monitoring wells are located. And you can look at the scale on the bottom and see these things are very close to each other. So, quite a detailed setup here. So what happened? Why am I calling this a failure? Well, in this case, we had some mobilization of contamination. If you look at the upper left-hand corner, this GW11, and it's outside the plume before these injections occur. On the right-hand side, immediately after the third injection happened, and they did sampling, the concentration had gone from non-detect to around 1,000 micrograms per liter. And then during rebound monitoring, it went up even higher to about 2,000 micrograms per liter. So this was not successful. Sometimes we do have issues with plumes being mobilized as a result of injection. And that's an important thing to monitor for and pay attention to. It's really good that they did do some sampling around the outside to see what was happening. And it's something to be mindful of when you are designing an injection technology in general. So other things that caused it not to be successful was they had quite a few clay lenses and they had lithologic heterogeneity that made it very difficult to get the oxidants where they needed to go because the oxidant really has to contact the contaminant. Here they use Fenton's reagent, which is a very active oxidant that works very vigorously for a short period of time and can have exothermic reactions. And we all believe that they redistributed the organic contaminants. And this was a site that was highly reducing in the subsurface prior to the injections. And so There was fouling of likely iron oxide precipitates that created a limitation on how much they could inject into the subsurface. And they did have a problem with daylighting. They just couldn't get the amount in the ground that they wanted to. Some other implementation issues. As I said, the oxidant has to contact the contaminant. There can be clogging through precipitation of minerals, and you can mobilize contamination. So one of the things that we do recommend, especially if you know you have an area of source area or higher concentrations, is work from an outside in direction where you start on the fringes and work towards the area of contamination rather than starting in the core and working out. So again, it was the incompatible geochemistry and the implementation issues that caused this one to not be successful. So generally, recommendations for ISCO, it's best if you possibly can have it where your subsurface geochemistry is oxidizing. Anytime you're doing changing the chemistry of the subsurface, I recommend a pilot study to see what happens, because if there is a problem, then you lose the money that the pilot study costs, but you don't lose the cost of a full-scale remedy, and you don't have to go back and redo your record of decision or decide on a different approach. And that's what I have on chemical oxidation, and I'll take some questions.
All right, so we're going to start with some questions that came into the queue earlier, but students are welcome to continue to submit their questions into that Q&A box. So, Judy, this very first one is a quick definition. Can you define sea sparge? Is that a commercial technology or just a professional term?
That's sort of the shape of how the ozone was injected. So it was injected and in a C shape. So I think there's probably a what do I call it, a patent on that. It's probably a trademark.
Okay. We have a question here about the range of contaminants that ozone is effective at treating.
So, like, what's the highest concentration it'll treat?
Maximins, yeah.
My experience is that the higher concentrations, like we had at the Piedmont example, when we had 20 milligrams per liter, it just takes longer. I don't think the concentration could necessarily stop chemical oxidation from working. It's just going to require more oxidant, and it's going to require a longer amount of time. There may be, anytime you have high concentrations, it increases your cost and it increases your time, regardless of the technology that you're going to try to use.
Okay. Would you say that you typically see contaminant rebound when you have an ISCO site? Like, is that a common theme? Just
It's
expect
not
it?
unusual. It's not unusual to see it. It was interesting to me that we didn't see it with the ozone sparging. So I guess that's an example that it doesn't always happen, but it's common for it to happen, and it's common to include that as a contingency.
Okay. So one of the attendees wanted to know, is the most common reason for that amount of rebound due to the variable geology and then presence of coarse and fine sediment, where the contaminants are essentially treated in the coarse sediment, but then back diffuse out of that fine sediment, which then looks like the rebound?
Yes, that's a very good possible explanation.
Okay.
Also, you cannot necessarily know where your source area is, and you think you got your source area, and then later on you discover, oh, we didn't characterize far enough, deep enough, wide enough, long enough, and there actually is more source material over in this other area that we didn't know about. And that also
Right.
happens.
Right. What was the sparging frequency in times? They wondered, was any sparging done in the bedrock wells?
Yes. It was, and they had the sparging was continuous 24 hours a day. I will say the one negative comment that we had from the people that were doing it that was in the document was ozone is pretty aggressive on equipment, so they had to do quite a bit of maintenance to keep their equipment going. to make the ozone and to inject it. But that was the only negative thing that I read in that document. So yeah, if it had been less of a, it just went very well, and it was a continuous injection, 24 hours for 200 days.
Okay, we have a few questions about the Piedmont site. I'm going to try to roll these up and maybe you can collectively respond to them. Some people would like to hear more about the bedrock relationship at the Piedmont site. Others want to know why did that example show origin of the contaminant mass or plume in the bedrock? Some people are asking, can I see materials from that ozone sparging in the bedrock? They've got stakeholders that have the same issue at one of their sites, so they would love to learn more. So, questions about Piedmont and the bedrock.
Okay, so this was a DNAPL situation. I would be willing to guess that the reason that it was present in bedrock was that it had originated somewhere and sunk down there, and that's what was left after the period of time that elapsed before they tried to do the remediation. So that's why it was down there.
Okay. All right. I do see a few more questions here on ISCO, but we also have a few recommendations that have come in from some practitioners. So I just wanted to read a couple of comments that have come in and then, Judy, just get your take on them. So one of the attendees noted that they've had more success using ISCO in conjunction with other technologies or as a quote, polishing step. They say that ozone has been easier to get distributed, and you have a constant source of that oxidant versus a liquid injection. So they just made that note and that you might see success of specific oxidants if you're studying them in the future. So I'm seeing nodding. So it sounds like you agree
Yeah,
that.
I like ozone, but I didn't have to operate the system. I didn't have to go out and repair it, right, and fix the things that were not happy with ozone, because the metal doesn't like ozone, and all the equipment pieces and parts have metal in them. So, but yeah, it's a great way to get it distributed. And yes, by doing it over a long period of time, it sort of overcomes some of the limitations with injecting a solid or a liquid.
Okay. Another comment, one of the practitioners said that when you're liberating the VOCs from things that like a native organic carbon, it's okay if you intend to continue the treatment. They note that native organics are like a sponge. So sometimes eliminating them to free up the VOCs for treatment is okay if you have those in hydraulic controls planned and aren't just ultimately mobilizing towards your receptor.
And if and that's a again, that's a design issue where you have to take that into account when you just decide how many injections you're going to do, how long you're going to do, how much you're going to inject. So
Okay.
that's part of the planning process. It can be addressed with proper engineering, but a lot of sites where it wasn't successful, that lack of success was because there wasn't enough planning about and enough work to decide to determine how much was going to be needed to address the natural oxidant demand.
Okay. Well, there are a few more examples in, but I think just in the interest of time, Judy, we're going to carry on with the presentation. And please know there are questions about multiple remedial technologies at sites and how things work together. So we may circle back at the end.
Yeah, I will say treatment train is always a good idea, but I would not limit ISCO to just polishing. I know some people are more comfortable with it as just polishing, but I think there are times and applications where it is appropriate, depending on how you design the system, for higher concentrations as well.
Excellent. Thank you.
So finally, enhanced reductive dechlorination. For those who may not have heard of it this way, it's injection of a carbon source into the subsurface or hydrogen. I'm actually going to do a hydrogen example in the presentation, which hopefully stimulates the indigenous bacteria to create reducing conditions. And typically, we use it to eliminate chlorine. So we'll take perchloroethylene, which has four chlorines, and go to hopefully knock it down to trichloroethylene, to cis12-DCE, to vinyl chloride, and then hopefully getting to ethane by eliminating all of the chlorines. So, how was it working based on the review that I did, looking at 39 sites? We had, let me see here, 23% were successful, 38% were, my slide is getting blocked by something. 38% were partially successful, and about the same amount were not successful. The main thing that caused partial success was a stall at Cis12-DCE or a stall at vinyl chloride. That was the main issue. The primary causes of reductive dechlorination poor performance include inadequate characterization, incompatible geochemistry, and implementation issues. So, back to our last poll that we have, just trying to find out what your experience is with reductive chlorination to address chlorinated solvents.
Okay, so that last poll question has now popped up asking simply how many sites are you working with that have used reductive dechlorination to address chlorinated solvents? Is it 0 to 5, 5 to 10, or more than 10? About half of you have responded. I'll give you just a few more seconds to share your response on in. You have been a fantastically engaged audience, so I thank you for continuing to interact and ask questions and share your feedback and responses through these interactive poll questions. It really does help us kind of get a pulse with where you are with our topic material. All right, it looks like about three quarters of you have responded, so I'll close the poll down in 3, 2, 1, and let's share those results. So,
Okay.
Judy, about 83% have 0 to 5, but what I can't tell you is how many of them were zero and how many were more than five.
Probably should have worded that differently. Oh, well. Okay, that's good to know. All right, let's move on. All right, so I'm going to present a hydrogen release compound pilot test case study. I have named this the Shoreline Military Site, partly because I didn't get permission to share. I just got information out of files, so I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. This is a hydrogen release compound study. A hydrogen release is a proprietary blend of viscous glycerol tripolylactate, which gradually releases hydrogen compounds to the subsurface, with the idea that it will stimulate the native bacteria to create the dechlorination. This is the setup of the pilot study. Pilot studies are normally over-designed. This one was certainly typical of what we see with really close injection and monitoring wells. The injection wells were blue. The monitoring wells are green in this example. So, very close to each other. So, look at MW39. What a fabulous result we have here. The TCE is shown in blue. They did not have perchloroethylene. They started with trichloroethylene. And after they did their hydrogen release compound, they started seeing this nice decrease in TCE, along with the simultaneous increase of the daughter product Cis12-DCE, which increased as the TCE decreased. This is almost like a textbook example of what you're looking for. And then we see vinyl chloride, which is in yellow, start to kick in as the Cis12-DCE starts to degrade. So as the Cis12-DCE goes down, the vinyl chloride goes up. And towards the end of the pilot study, everything was dropping off nicely. I don't have ethene information for this particular one. I have posted pH here because when I started doing this detailed file review for these projects, I started noticing that if pH was 6 or above, it seemed to be more successful. And I did some literature work, and there are quite a few references in literature that a pH of 6 or above is the best scenario for reductive dechlorination. So this is great. So if we just had this one well, we probably would say, let's go on with this and let's implement it full scale. However, just a few feet away, we have GW40. If you'll notice, the pH is somewhat below 6 on a couple of occasions and somewhat above 6 on others. We never saw any, or I never saw any vinyl chloride form during this pilot study, which was in the record. We had some increases in the Cis12-DCE that suggests, yeah, there was some breakdown of TCE to DCE, but it just wasn't really consistent. And obviously, they weren't done at the end of the study. So, as good as the other one was, this one was just that bad. And this is a great example of why a pilot study can really be helpful. Maybe they need to dig in a little bit more and find out what happened here. So, this is my viewpoint, that the pH was an issue. In the literature, you'll find many examples. Dehalicoides is one of the key organisms that will work to create dechlorination and to remove the chlorines, but Dehalicoides really likes the pH to be greater than 6. I'm sure there are exceptions, but that's just a general thing that I discovered doing my file review and confirmed it by looking at the record. In literature. Also, poor characterization. A lot of these facilities, including Shoreline Military Site, didn't even look to see if the Dehalicoides was present. If it had been absent, they could have looked at maybe doing a pilot study with bioaugmentation. And as I said, it's really a good thing they decided to do a pilot test rather than a full-scale operation here. Some of the implementation issues, as I've said, if you're trying to dechlorinate down to ethane, if your pH is less than 6 and you don't have dehalicoides, it's just not going to do it. If you can't get your dissolved oxygen low enough, it's not going to work. And John Wilson wrote a paper. He looked at pH, wasn't as strong on pH as he was on nitrate in his research. I believe it was nitrate concentrations over a milligram per liter would basically prevent dehalicoides from functioning. Again, that doesn't mean you cannot do bioaugmentation. It just means it's going to cost you more money. So, reductive dechlorination is most effective when you're starting out with a reducing subsurface condition. Because, and if you already find ethane or you already find dehalicoides, then you're more likely to be successful at that particular site. If you have a site and you go out there and you have just PCE or just TCE and no daughter products, that suggests maybe dehalicoides is absent. But always sample for it. It's easy, it's cheap now. It used to be a real complex and difficult thing, and only one or two places could do it. But now there's many options for that, and it's not that expensive. So it gives us more confidence that enhanced reductive dechlorination is a good option without bioaugmentation. Certainly, with bioaugmentation, you can overcome a lot of these unfavorable geochemical conditions, but I still think a microcosm study can be called for. If you are doing bioaugmentation, if you suspect the groundwater may be toxic to bioaugmentation, and microcosm studies are fairly easy to do at this point in time. So I have a few take-home messages. And one of the reasons I wanted to talk about these topics is we have very similar overlapping issues, even though the technologies were very different, how important good site characterization is. To know the limitations of your site geology and your site chemistry with respect to what your technology can and cannot do. It's easier to enhance your existing geochemistry rather than to try to change it drastically. I'm not saying it can't be done. I'm just saying it's easier if you stay within the same lane. It's what you start with. When you are injecting, I think checking for mounding and fouling is important. I like pilot studies just to check for fouling. And some people say mounding isn't a big deal because it always goes back to the way it was before. but I've had a couple of sites where we had that mobilization of contamination due to mounding, and 5 years later, it's still there. So we've made it worse. Indicator parameters are key. I'm going to talk a little bit more about indicator parameters and pilot studies as well, can really help you be successful. So, indicator parameters, this is just a little Judy Canova's ideal indicator parameters by technology. This is not set in stone. Everything can be tweaked a little bit, but with respect to reductive dechlorination, it'd be great if your aquifer starts out at less than one dissolved oxygen or less than negative 100 oxidation reduction potential. And if you're doing your injection of organic carbon, if you see those increasing TOC numbers, and again, in based on what I've seen, I think a pH greater than 6 is a great starting point. For chemical oxidation, dissolved oxygen, you would like to start out with a high dissolved oxygen and a high oxidation reduction potential, at least over 100 millivolts. A low total organic carbon is the ideal situation for chemical oxidation. Early on, the lower pHs used to have greater success rate. I know there's been a lot of engineering and a lot of work on chemical oxidants, so with the addition of catalysts, you can probably work with pHs over 6, but this was put together in the early days of chemical oxidation. It still is much easier if you don't have to add a lot of substances to have chemical oxidation work. And for PRBs, it depends on what type of chemistry you're trying to create. But using these indicator parameters will give you an early indication: is your technology working? An early indication: is this technology going to be likely to be successful? So something to keep in the back of your mind. And pilot studies, I think pilot studies should be used to help determine if a technology is appropriate. And I especially recommend them if you're changing the aquifer chemistry. I expect that they will overestimate success. So if your pilot study is successful, hopefully your full-scale implementation will be, but it may or may not be, might have to be tweaked a little bit more. But when you do an injection, pilot studies can help you figure out the radius of influence, how much the aquifer can receive, and if you're going to have delivery issues like clay lenses causing problems or fouling causing daylighting. So pilot study can be a very good tool to use to ensure your remedy is going to be successful. And it's nice to know that before you select a remedy and a record of decision, and you don't have to go back and amend it. So with that, I'll take any additional questions.
All right, thank you. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start with the ERD related questions, but I think we have suitable time that we may go back to some of the earlier technology questions as well. So let's start here with the ERD sites. And I will just say that some people are chiming in saying, I had the exact problem happen at one of my sites. Many people are noting that DCE, VC stalling causing a problem. They wanted to know why is there so much stalling with the CIS-1/2 DCE and VC? Is it just that they're harder to degrade with the ERD than TCE?
So I'm so glad whoever asked that question because it's an evolving science and we're understanding more and more about it. I went to a Clemson Hydrogeology Symposium a few years ago, and there was a presentation on the vinyl chloride stall. And what's happening is Dehalicocoides is the key organism. So first of all, there are a large number of organisms that will degrade and dechlorinate up to the CIS-1/2 DCE. So you can have CIS-1/2 DCE and have absolutely no Dehalicocoides at your site. But most of the time, when you get down to the vinyl chloride and ethene, that requires the presence of Dehalicocoides. And Dehalicocoides is very picky. It does not like certain conditions in the subsurface. pH is one of them, nitrate is one of them. But as studies have been performed on Dahalicocoides, they have this genetic sequencing now, so you can see, oh, this variety has the monochloride reductase gene. And the presentation that I saw at Clemson, they had done this evaluation of Dahalicocoides throughout, I believe, South Carolina, maybe North Carolina as well. And they had found that 25% of the Dahalicocoides in North and South Carolina was missing the vinyl chloride reductase gene. So they were seeing vinyl chloride stall because the genetic makeup of the Dahalicocoides was not adequate.
Okay. Getting back to this, what compounds do you see used for ERD that are the most successful? And they note, right, site conditions obviously matter.
Yeah, absolutely. So, like I said, if you go to a site and you are already seeing ethene and you're seeing the breakdown products, that's like a thumbs up for reductive dechlorination. My personal experience, the most successful reductive dechlorination site I was involved with was actually carbon tetrachloride. It was not chlorinated, so it wasn't the typical PCE pathway. And the reason that one I think was so successful was they were very consistent and they did continuous injections of very low concentrations of organic carbon, I believe it was molasses, over an extended period of time. And they had a very robust gridded injection points throughout the plume. So I think that really helped a lot.
Okay. Would you say in that ERD case study, did microbial characterization occur to see how that microbial population responded before?
So no, they did not ever analyze for
Okay.
Dahalicocoides. And that was one of the lessons learned from there is always do that. If that's a remedy that you think you may be interested in, it's great to find out from the get-go, is it already there? You can still do reductive dechlorination with some of the commercially available bioaugmentation cultures, but that's helpful to know at the beginning rather than at the end.
Right.
And I also think that doing a bioaugmentation, that's going to affect your cost. And I like to do microcosm. I recommend microcosm studies when we want to be sure that the bioaugmentation culture will work. One of the projects that I was involved in, the water was toxic to bioaugmentation cultures.
Okay.
So how would you know that if you don't try it? I mean, there's so many, it depends on your site and how confident you are that you know everything that's in your groundwater. Because we never did isolate what was so toxic to that bioaugmentation culture. We
Okay.
had theories, but we never figured out which one it was, what it was.
Okay. Another question. When you're considering ERD in a fractured bedrock and then conducting a tracer study during pre-design, they wonder, is there a minimum duration that your study should be conducted?
Well, that depends on the hydrology, hydraulic characteristics of your fractured rock and how long it's going to take to get your tracer into the location that you're interested in and how long it's going to take you to monitor what's going on there. So that's really a site-specific question. I do, if you are working for the Environmental Protection Agency and you're asking this question, I encourage you to ask your friendly neighborhood hydrogeologist who may be more familiar with your site-specific conditions that they could make a recommendation about the length of time that would be appropriate.
Okay. We have a few just comments from other practitioners of things that they've found at some of these sites. And one practitioner noted that at one of their sites, the injection of molasses improved dechlorination significantly.
Absolutely. That's one of the substances that we see a lot. We see molasses as well as lactate, very inexpensive. There's also vegetable oil or emulsified vegetable oil, depending on how fast your groundwater is going and how often you need to reinject. That's an engineering question of what sort of carbon source do you need. And there are other carbon sources that are mixed with zero valent iron. So there's a lot of options out there for sure.
Okay. And then just a note on looking at data, one of the other attendees has said that they found converting concentration to mass. So, in other words, micrograms per liter to micromoles is often a better way of looking at that ERD data so that the ERD transformation can be mass balanced. And a nodding head sounds like you would agree.
Yep. These all of these came from reports that I reviewed. I didn't do any additional workup on the data, but yes, I do like mass balance.
Okay, so I'm going to go back to some of the PRB questions that we had since we still have some time. One of these attendees wanted to know how much more difficult is it to install a V-shaped PRB or one of those PRBs with the elbows at the end as opposed to that single straight line PRB?
Well, all I can say is I was involved with one where we did it and it wasn't hard. It just takes a little bit of planning. So it depends on your site, but it's not that difficult to do. I think the key is really knowing how long it needs to be with that V shape, and we just kind of eyeballed it and felt like we can get it all if we make it this long and have a V at this location and have it at this angle. So
When we're talking about zero valence iron, so those ZVI type PRBs, have you ever seen mobilization of metals happen?
I've actually seen or read about in the literature zirconium iron being used to treat metals.
Okay.
It's actually been used to treat, I believe, arsenic in groundwater. So anytime you create new conditions in the subsurface, and this is another reason I like to use chemistry that matches the subsurface chemistry, is because I don't want to release anything from the subsurface by changing the chemistry. So when you go, if you're putting in a ZVI wall in an oxidizing setting, so the ZVI is reducing, it's going to re release water that is a low oxidation reduction potential. There are metals that happen to like that, and they may be mobilized, and it can be arsenic. Arsenic has five different oxidation states, so it depends on what oxidation state it's in as to whether ZVI is going to treat it or mobilize it. So that's another reason, trying to stay with the same chemistry so you don't mobilize anything.
Okay. What about a PRB when you have dissolved benzene for a very tight soil, like a clay, filthy clay? Do you
So,
think a
how would you
PRB
do
could
a
work there?
permeable reactive barrier in a clay?
Right.
Huh. I think I would be tempted to do the funneling gate if you had a very tight clay where you try to funnel it all to a particular area, because I just can't envision a very low permeability PRB would actually work. You actually need to have water pass through it at a reasonable speed. So I think with benzene in clay, I might lean towards oxygen release compounds, which is not something I talked about today, but it might be something worth checking out.
All right. What about you mentioned that seasonality is a factor when looking at your PRBs? They wonder, are there predictions regarding PRBs with the increase in severe storms? So I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that PRBs might be harder to design if we think that there's going to be a higher degree of groundwater level variation.
Absolutely. And that's a design kind of thing of trying to guess what sort of drought conditions are you going to experience, or what type of flooding conditions are you going to experience. And we've been experiencing both drought and flooding quite a bit in our nation over the last few years. So over designing the system to address those, there are models that are out there that can be used to sort of predict what your worst case scenario is going to be. I personally haven't been involved with trying to predict that for a PRB design, but it is certainly something you can think about if you have a concern about that as a potential issue.
Okay. A question about depth of placing your PRB. And particularly, they note if you have multiple groundwater zones, like how can you begin to design and how deep do you go? Any thoughts?
Yes, and I am not a PRB expert. Like, I haven't put in multiple PRBs. Personally, I've seen presentations from firms who say they can get, way down there, 100 feet, 200 feet with their technology. And I haven't personally been involved with overseeing or reviewing the findings there. One thing about the bottom of a PRB is you would like to put it in some type of impermeable material, which I didn't really mention in my presentation, because you don't want underflow. And so I have seen some PRBs that were not keyed in to an underlying unit that was low conductivity, and they all have underflow, the ones that don't have that bottom sealed off. So
Okay.
that's about the best I have to offer.
Well, getting back to that gypsum formation problem, what kind of pre-testing would you have recommends to identify that issue ahead of time?
Well, we could have done that in a bench scale, right? We could
Right.
have grabbed a water sample, sent it to the lab, and had them add it to calcium carbonate to see what happened. But honestly, if you talk to a chemist with basic chemistry understanding would have been able to make that prediction.
Okay. All right. We're going to move over to some ISCO questions. And someone wanted to just double check. Did you mean chemical sparging instead of air sparging?
Now, C is the shape of the air sparging unit. It's a C
Okay.
shape.
Gotcha. All right. And then one of the attendees asked, are there ISCO methods that can work in low permeability areas? They're just wondering what you might recommend for secondary sources of NAPL.
So, low permeability areas are definitely a problem that we've been thinking about for a long time and trying to come up with approaches. And basically, you have to create permeability where there is an absence of permeability. So, fracking is what I have seen used to allow to create permeability. I was involved with the site in clay. Sandy clay, clay sand, saprolite, which was weathered rock. And we used an injection technology that just blasted the aquifer to smithereens as we were injecting carbon-coated zero-valent iron. And it worked quite nicely. It took a lot of planning and it took a lot of work, but it was one of the few technologies that we were able to use that was viable for that particular project.
Okay. I have a question here about chlorinated ethenes and ethanes. And that's all
Okay.
that it says. So I would interpret it as you will. I'm assuming applicability for an ISCO project.
I don't know if that might be a reductive dechlorination question. The nice thing about 111 trichloroethane, which is a common chemical that we find in the subsurface as well, there's a lot more focus on the perchloroethylene to vinyl chloride and ethane pathway because it's so much more difficult to achieve. But with 111 trichloroethane, USGS has a nice paper out that talks about how easily that degrades and how quickly that degrades to daughter products. And a lot of sites, they have 111 trichloroethane and it goes away on its own fairly quickly if the source is eliminated. So that's my commentary on that topic.
Okay. Can you speak about any projects that were in mildly reducing conditions where the ISCO was actually effective, or did the conditions always need to be oxidizing?
No, certainly if you're between that plus 100 minus 100 ORP, that's kind of my range if you can probably be successful. I mean, again, this is just me. I'm just one person and I've just reviewed these records. But what I've seen is if you have the range between plus and minus 100 millivolts on your ORP and your dissolved oxygen isn't missing, but it's not really high, then you have more flexibility with what you choose, and it's not one technology over another one. And you can engineer any technology you want to. Again, the idea behind this presentation is what's going to give you a better chance of success. It's not going to guarantee success, but it's a better chance. But you can engineer it certainly between that range of negative 100 and plus 100 ORP.
Sure. So I have a question about the injection radius, and I think this is the ISCO related case study, but correct me if I'm wrong. They're asking, is the injection radius of influence typically larger when you're injecting a gas versus a liquid? And if that is there a recommended ballpark amount, such as 2 times bigger?
I wish I knew the answer to that question. I don't know. I will say when you're doing any type of gas, whether it's ozone or air, and you're injecting it, most of the time the sea sparge overcomes this, but if you're just doing regular injections in a perforated, well, then you're going to have a cone at the bottom where the injection is occurring. It's going to be really close to the borehole. But by the time the gas gets to ground surface, 30 or 40 feet up, it's going to spread out and disperse horizontally. But with
Okay.
the sea sparge, they were able to make it a column shape radius of influence. So that's about all I can say is there you can do air sparging or ozone sparging using a different configuration to create that column. Because when you just have a cone shape, you're missing a whole lot of contamination at the bottom of those cones.
Okay. We just had a clarifying question or from the presentation, what would you define as high nitrate? Can you quantify?
So that's out of John Wilson's paper. I called it high. You may not think it's high, but anything above 1 milligram per liter was what's in his paper.
Okay. We have a question in here about plume containment. So they wonder, how are we actually achieving plume containment at these sites aside from the PRB? They wondered if remedies or the case studies that you were highlighting were being operated alongside pump and treats or PRBs or other techniques to prevent plume migration.
Some yes and some no. Most of these did not have a containment system associated with them. There were some that were trying to control their source area with one technology. I had one project I was involved with a while back that did both. This is going to sound really wild and it's probably going to give you a headache, but they did both chemical oxidation and zero-valent iron. They did chemical oxidation by injecting solid permanganate into bedrock, which was a
Okay.
very interesting experience for them. And it was successful in lowering concentrations. And then at a distance, I don't know if it was a quarter of a mile or less than a quarter of a mile, there was a surface water body that they wanted to protect, and they put in a zero-valent iron permeable reactive barrier.
Huh.
So that was one example of a source treatment being different from the sort of the polishing at the end of the plume.
Okay. All right. We are coming up at 2:27. So I'm going to take one last question for you today. And this is a bit of a recommendation, and they want to get your take on it. So this participant notes that it sounds like characterization of the subsurface. So when you're looking at your aquifer properties, it is vital to assess for a successful remedy. So they wonder if you find that assessment and investigation should consist of multiple means, multiple data sets beyond conventional subsurface sampling. So, for example, they list a whole series of technologies, LIFF, UVOST, MIP, CPT, and aquifer testing.
There are a lot of technologies that are available now that we didn't have when I first got started. And the more lines of evidence that you collect, the better. But there also has to be a consideration to cost. I do have an RPM hat, a remedial project manager hat, which means sometimes we just need to collect enough data to have confidence in our design. Do we need to do LIFF at every site? No, we do not. Do we need to do some of these other technologies at every site? No. It depends on the level of detail that you need for the particular remedy that you're choosing. If you choose to do pump and treat, you don't necessarily have to do high resolution work. And I don't think every site has to be high resolution, but I think we should use that tool because it is available to us, because it will end up saving us money and time in the long run. But it's a site-by-site decision.
Okay. Well, Judy, I think we have run short of time to carry on, but we've got through the bulk of the questions. So I want to thank you so very much for your time and your expertise today. And with that, I'm going to walk through just a few quick final reminders before I close out today's session. So the first thing that I want to do is encourage everybody to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network at cluin.org. And be sure to sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which I send out on the first of each month. We are continuously looking for new subscribers, for feedback, for recommendations. So if you found today's topic helpful, I encourage you to sign up for Tech Direct because we'll highlight future sessions, such as today's webinar in that newsletter. Now, there is a unique seminar homepage. It's shown in red at the top of this slide. You can also access it by scanning the QR code on the right side of the slide. That website will remain active from today forward, and it's where you can access the presentation materials as well as a whole suite of resources on our topic. We have case studies and databases and information on these various technologies from Cluin that we've pulled together and put on the resource or related link section. So I encourage you to visit that website. Feel free to share it with other colleagues. Again, it'll stay active from today forward. For those of you looking for certificates of participation, you can get one of those based on your submission of an online feedback form after attending today's broadcast. So if you visit that seminar homepage and scroll down to the feedback form section and fill out that form, making sure that you check the box at the bottom, certifying that you were here for the entire session, as soon as you submit the feedback form, you should immediately have access to a certificate of participation that you can download or print out from a confirmation screen. I will email a copy to you, but those oftentimes get caught up in junk or spam filters, so I encourage you to download it right from that screen once you submit the form. If you run into any difficulties, feel free to email me directly. I'll be happy to pull the certificate and manually resend in if need be. For those of you that hosted a viewing party, please know that you have a special place in my heart. I love viewing parties, but if you were the one that registered and opened up the viewing party at your location, I simply ask that you share the link to the seminar homepage with all of those who joined you in the room. Each person can fill out that feedback form to get their own individual certificate, even though they didn't register on their own. Please know I do read each and every one of your submissions, and your feedback helps us to continue to offer free technical sessions like our webinar today. And so with that, I'll let everybody know that our session was recorded. I will have an archive available in about a week. You'll get an automated email from me when that recording is available for on-demand playback. And if you happen to be one of the lucky people who has watched this entire archive and have made it back to that point, right around now in the recorded version above my head in the upper right corner, there will be a link to the seminar homepage as well as a link to the seminar feedback form. You can still share feedback based on your replay of the archive and receive a certificate of participation. So I can encourage you to continue to share your thoughts based on the replay. With that, I want to thank the over 270 individuals who joined us from all across the world. We had a number of international attendees today. We hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time and that you'll join us on a future Cluin webinar. With that, I'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much for joining us.